Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into the interview. We've got an amazing guest. I've been wanting to interview this cat for so long. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Greg Leon. Say hello, Greg.
Hello. How you doing, everybody?
Ooh, our studio audience loves you already.
Can't beat that.
You can just silence them when they get out of hand. That's it.
You better shut up because I'm going to talk.
So the cool thing about interviewing you is I could literally interview you in all facets of your career, from your storied youth to your storied I'm going to be in a band to the storied I'm going to just rub shoulders and play with every badass musician because I am a badass. And you also, you do so much. We're going to jump right into it. Let me ask you, you grew up in Glendale, California.
I did, yeah.
We're neighbors, by the way. I grew up in Arcadia.
Oh, right on.
So you grew up in Glendale. What was the moment of zen that made you get into music?
Well, my dad was a musician, and my mom also, but she didn't let us know that she was a musician or sang or anything until much later, like the later years of her life. She did not want me to be a musician, but my dad sang every day, and he was a really good-looking Italian guy, and his name was Major, of all things.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Major Leon. But he sang every day, played piano. We played harmonica, too. And the moment that I knew that's what I wanted to do, I did a talent show in junior high school with my little band that I had, and we did Johnny B. Goode, Hendrix style.
That's awesome.
We did Inside Looking Out from Grand Funk Railroad.
Yeah.
And we did one other thing, probably a Foghat song or something like that, and the crowd went crazy. There was like 3,000 kids in my junior high school,
wow.
I think. Yeah, it was big. It was Roosevelt Junior High School in Glendale. And so they had two little assemblies, you know, for the talent show. Well, everybody was at the first one because nobody knew I could really play like that except my close friends. And, you know, the guys in my band and maybe there were a couple dozen people that we'd have over to my house and my folks' house in the living room, and we'd have parties after school.
So it was a neighborhood secret.
Yeah. And so anyways, we did this thing. There was people just standing everywhere the next assembly they had. And everybody,
I'm sure people
school.
Ditched to see
yeah,
it again.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. And obviously we won, and then people started having parties all the time so they could have me and my guys play there. And that's how it started, and it was just so fun. I mean, there's girls that, you know, you're in junior high, I mean, you just dream about
it.
This is
it. See, what, when did you start playing?
I started out as a drummer.
Wow.
And I had bands as a drummer.
See, I've never known that. This is crazy.
Yeah, I still play drums. I have in fact, one of the songs we're going to play today, I play everything on it. And yeah, I started out as a drummer, and I watched the guys in my band play guitar, and I would remember the positions of their hands, and they would leave their guitars there for the weekend.
You just pick it up.
When they would leave, I would just pick them up and start practicing. And within 6 months, because I could always sing. I was always a singer in every band I was in.
Did you sing and play drums?
Yeah.
Dude, I think that's the hardest combination of all.
It didn't bother me at all. My dad just told me, don't think about it. You'll be able to do it, but don't think about it because it'll mess you up. So I just did it. We played all the, you know, the junior high dances. We played a couple of high school dances. and as a drummer.
You must have been like the town legend at era and that time. Nobody was doing it like that.
I used to tell my dad that, and my dad goes, "No, you don't want to brag about yourself. Let other people brag for you." But I knew that that's what people were saying,
right?
Because I saw the response I got out of people. But it was pretty. Everything evolved around me for years.
And you get addicted to that sound, the crowd, the girls. You're getting that attention in all the right ways, and you're doing something you love too. It's not like something you're faking. You know, it's like love it. You know,
but I didn't get into it for the girls or anything like that. I just loved playing guitar and singing. I mean, that was what I did. I didn't even know that you were opera trained. I just read that today.
Yeah,
man. And I've known you for years.
And you know what? I kept that a secret from everybody because it's like, that's the last thing I want to do is like hang out with my friends and be like, "Hey, by the way, I sing classical music. You guys want to hear an aria?" Like, no way. It's just not what you do. Yeah. But it's like you love music and you end up following what it is because you love it. And if you get accolades, great. But none of that matters because all that matters is when you pick up an instrument and you can play that feeling. It never gets old.
It doesn't get old. And you've got your two or three people in the band with you, or sometimes four or whatever. And you have a killer show, man. There is nothing like because you actually did something that not everybody can do.
Right. And do you remember the song that made you want to play drums or the band?
Well, my dad was really into Gene Krupa.
Wow.
And, you know, the big bands. My dad was a big band singer. He had a voice that was like a perfect mix between Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley.
Wow.
And he was really good looking, and he sang all of it, but he got
a crooner.
He was a crooner, and he knew every damn song. He could remember the words to everything. It was amazing. So I grew up with music in the house all the time, and the Gene Krupa Sing, 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 you know, and all these songs from, you know.
And the arrangements on those are so
They're incredible. Lush. And so I used to practice my drums to those songs as a kid, and then I got into Zeppelin, and I got into Hendrix, you know, and man, I mean, that Hendrix. And then I used to love playing Fire by Jimi Hendrix because it's all drums. It's
my favorite song, dude.
High five.
That's my favorite Hendrix song.
High five.
No, it really is. It really is.
No, I believe it. Why would you lie to me now?
Dude. No, but you know what? You listen to, and isn't it funny that a lot of that stuff, like Hendrix didn't break in the U.S., he broke in England. Right. And Zeppelin broke in England. Yeah. Like there was this huge resurgence of blues and rock.
That is so funny that you mentioned that. Yeah, because I was trying to break here and I could not get the attention. I mean, we sold out every place in my old band, Sweet 19 in Glendale, when we went to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because we'd played parties like Van Halen did. Backyard parties, 300, 400, 500 people every single weekend. So when we started playing at Gazzari's and the Whiskey, then we became the house band at the Starwood. Every night we played, it was sold out. We did two sets a night, but we couldn't get the attention. So when I joined Dokken, one of the main reasons I joined was because he said, "Well, I got some European tour dates."
And you're I'm in.
We didn't even have lyrics. We were writing lyrics on the plane going over to start our tour in Hamburg, Germany.
Now, there's got to be like, there was a scene. Right,
oh,
so you're playing in the scene, and it's like you know what other bands are doing.
Yeah,
and was there like a rivalry? Did you have like, or was it like all kind of like good blood? Everybody's kind of jamming with people.
I'm a really competitive person with my bands.
I think every musician is on some level.
I think if you're good, you gotta have that because if you don't want to be better than everybody else, you're not gonna be.
Right, right.
You gotta be single-minded. You gotta be obsessed with it. And I used to drive my sisters crazy. You know, I'd be playing all the time and. You know, just trying to figure out how did Johnny Winters bend that note like that?
Right.
Or Hendrix, you know, getting that sustain or whatever it was. You just work on it and work on it till it's second nature. And then you incorporate it into your own style and develop your own style. But, I got a little sidetracked. I was thinking of something else. But
that's all right. So you know what? So when you're kind of rubbing shoulders with all these neighborhood bands that are becoming bigger and bigger with their followings, is there like a cross-pollination of styles?
Well,
is there,
I was playing a party in Glendale at the Chevy Chase Country Club. A friend of mine, Martin Oliver, had a party. And we had about 350 people in the rec room there.
Amazing.
Well, and I'm playing away. I got my Fender Jaguar, and we're doing some Frank Marino. We're doing talking about a feeling or something.
Yeah.
And I see these two guys walk in. I didn't know who the hell they were, but I knew they weren't people that went to school with me. So I'm watching them, and they're watching me, and all of a sudden they're right in front of me, and I take a little break, and they start talking to me. "Hey, man, how do you get that tremolo to go so low on a Jaguar?" You know, and I said, "Well, I took the spring and I pulled it out really far and I bent the tremolo arm up so it's got more travel and I could do the dive bombs and stuff. And you can pull up on a Fender Jaguar tremolo." And so we started talking. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know nothing. But I just knew they weren't from where I was, you know. So a couple of years later, I go to Glendale College, and there's a concert, and it's Van Halen and Quiet Riot. And my drummer at the time was the head custodian of Glendale Unified School District. So earlier in the day, he printed up some reserved seat things, and that was for me, him, and the bass player. So we're front row center.
That's awesome.
And I'd never seen either of those bands, and I'm the hot guy in Glendale at the time, right. You know, and everybody just, oh, Greg's up front. Of course Greg's up front, you know. And
so, you're like, you know, damn right I am.
Yeah. So Quiet Riot comes out. They were great. Randy looked beautiful. I mean, he was the best looking guy around, and well, besides Dave Roth at the time, but
he's
up there, he's all dressed up, and, you know, they got a show.
They had a vibe.
They had a vibe, they had a show. So I go backstage, and I'm looking for Randy, and I go into Van Halen's dressing room. And Dave goes, nah, man, they're down the street, down in the two doors down. So I walk in there, and Randy's sick as a dog. He's got the flu. He's, like, barely standing up. Talk to him, you know, to introduce myself, and we became friends. Then Van Halen comes out. I was like, what in the hell? Because people have been telling me about this guy from Pasadena.
This is past the years they were booed off stage at Pasadena High and all of that, right?
So they come out and they do their show, and I go, oh, that's the guys that were at my party. It was Dave and Eddie that came up and talked to me. And, it was just, wow. It was like that aha moment, you know? So I went back and I met them. Years later, Eddie and I, we met at a club that I used to play at a club called the Woodsound out in Monrovia, and we went back in the office and partied all night. I mean, it was just the best guitar player in the world, and then me. And we're
who is also one of the best guitar players in the world, let's be honest.
And we're handing a guitar back and forth, and I go, dude, let me see your hands. Let me see how big your hands are. And so we put our hands up to next to our hands were the exact same size. We're just normal size hands. They're not huge, but... You know, and Randy had tiny little hands.
Right. And he played really light strings, too.
I play light strings.
Okay, okay.
On my Strats, I use 9s, and on everything else with a fixed tailpiece, I use 8s. And even on acoustic, I use 10s, only because I would go lighter, but they just don't sound. That's the lightest you can go with it, still making some kind of
Before tone. We play something, because, man, I could sit and talk gear and all these stories for years. When did you start tinkering with guitars? Because you were talking about taking the springs out,
well,
and I was like,
the deal.
That's not the average guitar player right
here's
there.
The deal. I grew up really poor.
Right.
Really poor. My dad, we had more love in our house, and this is crazy, but we had no money. My dad was a barber, and the Beatles were big, so everybody had long hair, including me. You know, I didn't want a hair. I remember running away from home, and he'd bring his clippers home. You know, I'd say, oh, no.
Like, I gotta have it long, Dad. 12
years old, I gotta have hair, man. And I keep thinking about other stuff and losing my train.
That's all right.
So, what was the question?
I was talking about, like, when did you start tinkering with
tinkering.
Guitars?
Oh, tinkering. We were really broke. So there was this one time where I had this wah-wah, a Cromwell wah-wah, Japanese Cromwell, and something had quit working. So I had an old TV with a bunch of resistors, and I pulled all the resistors out of the wah-wah and just put resistors new one. I go, it's got to be one of those. I didn't know that each one of those resistors had a value, and each one did a certain thing in the circuit. So I pulled them all out, and I took them to Charles Music in Glendale, and they had used to have an in-house repair guy there. And this is junior high school. And the guy goes, I'll fix it, but don't call me on it. Just, you know, I'll call you when I'm done. I'm just going to do this on my downtime because you really messed this thing up, you know. So I get a phone call a couple of weeks later, hey, your wah-wah's done. And I go, how much is it? And the guy goes, $10. I go, oh, God, I got to ask my dad for $10. This is stupid. So my dad and I go down there because he loved me, and he would, whatever it took to get me across.
That's
or
awesome.
You know, yeah, he was the best. So he takes me down there, and as he's handing the $10, he looks at me because, you know, money doesn't grow on trees. If you're going to be a musician, you better learn how to fix this stuff.
Wow.
So this was
Smart
summer.
Man.
Yeah, this was summer, and almost ready to go back to school. So when we were picking the classes wanted to take, I took electricity. And then that went into, and I'd already
taken. That's when you learned to solder and stuff.
Yeah, and I took every electrical class all through school, every one of them. TV repair, everything, and I aced everything. And then I got a full scholarship to DeVry Institute of Technology in Arizona. And I went there for a while, but I hated it. Because all it was math problems. And I like to fix things. I like hands-on.
You want hands-on, yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm good with math, but that wasn't what I wanted to do. So after
you wanted to tinker.
I wanted to tinker. I'm the tinker. So I come back, and surprised, I didn't tell anybody I was coming back. I just, one morning, my dad's getting ready to go to work, and there's a knock at the door, and it's me. And everybody in the house started crying. They couldn't believe I was back. And
the Italian.
So, hey, where are you back? Where? What are you fucking doing, huh? Where you thought you were in school?
So anyways, I come back and then I went to, I got a job at an electronics place, and then I kept moving up the ranks. And the whole time I'm playing in bands all the time, parties every weekend, and sometimes Sunday nights, and I had to be at work early Monday morning, 7 o'clock I had to be there. So some nights, if we were out like three or, you know, two
you
or three.
You didn't sleep.
I didn't sleep. I would go and pull my El Camino.
You were that guy. You were
I
that
would
guy.
Pull my El Camino with all the equipment in the back up behind the building that I worked at and go to sleep in the front seat of my car. And the light would, the sun would start coming in.
You're like, oh, shit, I got to go to work.
Yeah, sometimes I'd be in the clothes that I wore the other night, like all frilly stuff.
But that you're like a legend at that point. Yeah.
I was just this kid in Glendale. Delinquent. That was, you know. But I'd walk in and they'd go, "Who the hell, Greg? Where the hell have you been?"
But until they see you play, when they see you play, they're like, "Oh, you're actually legit."
Yeah, but these were like really old people that had been in this company for like 50 years. I got everybody their raises because they were too scared to talk, and I didn't care. Right. That wasn't my career then.
Right, right.
You know, I went in and complained to the owner, and the next thing you know, everybody had back in the day, it was like a 50-cent raise back, but that was in 77. That was a big deal.
Yep.
Because they were making like $1.68 or something like that an hour. Oh, it was just terrible. You couldn't do anything with that.
And
money.
So tell me what it was like. I always wonder this. It's so amazing I get to interview you and ask you this question. So like, you know, I always just assumed because the record industry was just very close-knit and it was like run by mobsters really from 50 to, I'd say, even to now a little
even
bit.
Even
to
now, yeah.
But like getting into a studio, what was it? Were you able to get an indie rate? I don't even know if that exists.
I would have people come and see me play, and they would go, "You know what? I own a studio. Let me make you a demo. My
That's
no charge.
Amazing.
Wow. All you got to do is buy the tape. You can come in at midnight and work all the way through till the morning or till, you know, midday when the next thing comes through." And I did stuff like that, but I didn't know how to shop it. I didn't have the connections stuff. So I just end up with all these tapes and stuff and, you know, and the clubs were playing the crap out of us.
You know, I think that's every artist.
Oh, yeah.
That's every artist's obstacle. It's like there's this bridge of, like, they know how to make the content, and that's the most beautiful. That's all they should know how to do.
Yeah, that's right.
And the industry doesn't, like, they don't go across the bridge to kind of, like, garner, like, you know, the attention for the artist.
You're 100%
right. It's a lot of bullshit. So, you know, it's
total bullshit.
But
and nobody tells you,
what
the steps are.
Right.
And
there are no steps. There are no steps. It's like, oh, you could be kicking ass, but guess what? I am the head of a label, and my nephew, who isn't really great, he's going to get a record
nepotism
deal.
Nepotism is huge.
Yeah, it's all part of it.
I remember a couple of times, one of them was Warner Brothers. We thought we were going to get signed to Warner Brothers. We're selling out every place, and there was this guy that was working there. He's taking us out, whining and dining us, getting contracts drawn up, redoing the contract when we don't like something. All of a sudden, we go in some Monday, and they go, "He doesn't work here anymore." And I didn't know this happened.
Yeah.
But we were his baby. So once he was gone, they didn't even want us in the building.
That's how it works. Unless you're the crown jewel, they just
the
don't
care. What that all about?
Yeah.
You know, we're just about ready to sign. And it was Marshall Borough Company, the same people that signed Van Halen originally, the management and stuff. And it was a guy that worked there. But, you know, people go, "Well, you were better than anybody. How come you didn't make it?" You know, and now that I'm older, I look back, and my mother used to say, and my dad too. My dad was not religious, but my mother's very religious. Would tell me, "You know, you're probably being protected. Look at your buddy Randy; he makes it and he gets killed."
You know what? It's very true. It's like sometimes you think there's no blessing, but there's always
huge blessings.
Something.
I've got so much to be thankful for. It's every night when my wife and I go to bed, every morning, because she's an amazing singer too.
Right.
She's amazing songwriter.
We're going to play some of that.
She's gorgeous. I mean, she's drop dead gorgeous. You know, and she was huge in Japan. She was huge in Canada.
She's
where
like,
she
not
got
Japan.
From. She toured for 10 years straight, six nights a week, only had one day off, and that was travel day. And she played all these clubs. Everybody knows her in Canada and the west coast of Canada. Comes here, can't get anything together. All guys want to do is, you know, get in her pants, or they just talk bullshit to get to know her, but they don't follow through with anything.
Well, because the people that run a lot of these companies, they don't care about the art.
No, they don't care about the art.
Let's play something. Before we do this, let's play something. We're going to start with a song, Greg Leon Invasion. This is Soldier of Love.
I'm
a nap after that.
Man, I mean, my nipples are.
Yours too?
Dude, first of all, your guitar tone is ridiculous. Oh,
man, thank you.
Ridiculous. Second of all, you're playing strums, and then you're comping, and then you're playing solos. What? That's just nuts. Yeah, like, well, you would think you would just play like a rhythm track, but you're doing it all at once.
No, there's a bunch of stuff going on. You know, I've always played in almost always played in three-piece bands.
So you know when to take that.
I had to fill in those holes and not make it sound cluttered. So you got to get clever and really think through it, and then just keep doing it till you don't think about it. And then it's just, you know, it sounds like it's pretty simple, but there's a lot going on. There's a lot of movement along with the.
Well, it's also like the moments that you take to like capture lightning in a bottle. It's like, okay, here's a solo. Here's a little guitar. Yeah. Like, I love when songwriters or performers or guitarists or singers. When they do that with any part of the instrument, when it's like they can just like, here's a moment of flair. It's just like, damn. That's...
The drummer on that song is Mark Gervais from Survivor.
Amazing.
Yeah, and he saw my drum set because I have the most outrageously bitchin' early 60s.
Ludwig, right?
Green sparkle drum set with a 28-inch bass drum, 14, 16, 18. And he saw that. He walked in my studio, he goes, I'll do it.
Really? You're like, wow, that was easy.
And he's a super nice guy. So what I would do is I'd write a song. And the bass player is Stuart Brooks from England. He was in the Pretty Things. And he was in the original lineup that turned into the band Free.
Wow.
He didn't like Paul Rogers' voice. So he said, and it was his band. He goes, well, you guys do whatever you want, but I'm not going to have that guy in my band. So they went with the other guys. And him and I played together for about 9 years. In fact, we just played together last weekend. It was awesome.
Dude,
awesome.
Let's talk about some of the people you played with. You were in a band with Tommy Lee for
a
little bit?
I was in a band with Tommy Lee.
Tell me what that was like.
Sweet 19. The guy is crazy. But the funniest thing, and he bugged me to be my drummer. I had a guy named Gary Hellinan in the band who was in Sweet 19 with me. For some or whatever, I don't even know why, we had a falling out. And Tommy had been after me forever to play in the band. He loved my old band, Sweet 19. And we did like half covers, half originals. And anyway, so he was just this kid. And I go, oh, come on, dude. You know,
I'm
22 thinking I'm all this, you know.
And yeah, naturally.
Like 17 or 18.
Right.
So I didn't have a drummer, and I was auditioning drummers, and I ran into him. He goes, dude, just come to my house. I got a full-on rehearsal room my dad built for me. It was a room inside of a room that was completely soundproof. His parents' bedroom was upstairs. We would play all night,
and they take a
nap,
and
they didn't hear anything.
What?
And he knew every one of my songs perfect.
Wow.
Respect. And we became like this. And then I got the Dokken offer. I got a call from Randy Rhodes and Kevin DeBrow, because Randy got the gig with Ozzy, and I was Randy's favorite guitar player. So,
dude, you just gave me chills. Say that one more time so everybody can hear it nice and slow. Okay. You were
Randy Rhodes' favorite guitar player.
That's an amazing amount of respect.
Yeah, he was a good guy, man. He was a really gentle, sweet soul, and just a nice guy.
That's an amazing compliment, too, man.
He had a wicked sense of humor, man, and I have a good sense of humor, too, but some people have this sarcastic, like George Lynch has a very sarcastic sense of humor.
Right.
And I just love it. It just cracks me up when people come off like that and come up with these things. So,
right. It's like dark and twisted and obnoxious, but also
awesome,
fiery.
Because you know it's all in fun.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
But Randy, and then, you know, I left the Sweet 19 and Tommy Lee and all that to go with Quiet Riot, you know. And then we decided to change the name to DeBrow until we got a record deal, because nobody was going to sign the name Quiet Riot because of Kevin DeBrow. He was pretty much blackballed.
Why is that?
His mouth.
He's
very mean to people.
Vocal.
And very, very vocal. I've never met a guy more opinionated. He had an opinion on everything. I what do you think of this water?
And he would just go, oh, yeah. Right.
We couldn't just say it's good or it's bad. He'd have to go. And he was just mean-spirited. And it got very hard to play with him. And you know me. I'm not a mean guy. I like having fun. Him and I went to blows twice.
Wow.
I remember Drew,
really?
The drummer, and he was 6'4". I'm 5'7".
Dude,
and I had him in a
headlock.
I can't
imagine you fighting, man.
Oh, no, my dad was a pro boxer, and I know how to fight.
Okay, so you knew.
I hate it.
You're like, I'm not going to take any shit from anybody.
I broke a couple of kids' noses in junior high school. One punch, it was over. My dad always said, if you don't get it in the first few punches,
that's it.
They're going to, you know, you got to get it over before it starts. So one guy, I thought I killed him. He was on the floor. You know, he went almost like, I thought I broke his nose and pushed it up into his brain.
And where are your guitars during all this?
This was junior high. By the time I got to high school, well, there was only a couple of fights, and it was all people jealous.
Right.
You know, I remember this one guy, I'm not going to mention
his name. You're fighting
for
your rep at that point.
Yeah, and, you know, I kicked him out of my band because he was my best friend, but I kicked him out because he couldn't play bass. He was just my best friend, and he wanted to play bass. So I wouldn't fight him. I kept telling him, I go, dude, I'm not going to fight you. This is not worth anything. Our friendship's more important than this. This is just a stupid band, you know, come on.
Right.
But that was his dream, to play with me.
Right.
And so he went and started picking a fight with my girlfriend at the time.
Ooh.
And pulling her hair. And then he cold cocked me a couple days later. And we got into a fight. Then it's a long story.
But let me teach you a lesson.
Just jealous. I ended up beating the hell out of him afterwards. But it's nonsense. And people right. are so crazy when they're young and they make stupid mistakes.
Well, you're in a level of, I have a lot to prove.
Yeah.
I have fire in my veins. I'm competitive as ever because it's like survival of the fittest. There are a lot of illusions that you're fighting demons. You have a lot to prove. You're getting out of your childhood and into trying to prove yourself as an adult. Yeah. So it makes sense.
When you're young, you got a lot of piss and vinegar. And
totally.
When you get older, you find it in your bed when you wake up in the morning.
Yes. And on that note, let's play the second song. It says, Don't Want to Say...
Yeah, this is off the Unfinished Business record. And it's me, George Rolke on bass, and Greg Stevens on drums. And we did this. Everything's been done that you're going to hear in my studio. I still run tape. I have
I love that. I saw your studio the other day, and I was like,
it's awesome, man.
It's amazing. Nobody does that anymore. I mean, I love making records on
tape. I go to somebody's house, and they say, yeah, I got a recording studio. And I walk in, and they got a laptop on it.
Right. And you're like, that's not
really?
A studio.
You saw the walls of equipment, vintage equipment.
You got racks.
Racks of equipment. You know, the tape machines.
Those are the racks I really go crazy for.
Right, exactly. And all the right stuff, you know, a big mic locker, and, you know, you can make real records then.
Right.
But these guys nowadays, everything's in Pro Tools, everything's the same.
Everything sounds on a box. Yeah.
I've done sessions where I come in, and it does sound good, and it's gotten a lot better.
But it's not like
making it. But there's something like the way the bass drum and the snare.
The sustain on a guitar on tape. A vocal on tape, a drum on tape, a snare drum, a kick drum.
I can tell
at all. Bass.
One hit, whether it was done on Pro Tools or it was taped, just from the snare.
Yeah, because it's got compression and all this bullshit. But you know what? With tape, you hear the dimensions.
Oh, you can take it and saturate it so far. I mean, you can go +6, +8, +10 on a snare on a transient like
that.
It still
digital.
Sounds great now.
Yep. What I also say with tape, it's like it forces you to listen.
Yeah.
Whereas like when you're doing with digital, you make decisions. Exactly. But you're looking at the music instead of hearing.
Yeah.
So what's the name of this track?
Don't Want to Say I'm Sorry. It's off the Unfinished Business record.
Okay. Cool. Greg Leon Invasion. Don't Want to Say I'm Sorry. We'll be right back. Yeah, man, you got some vocals, man.
Oh, thanks, man.
Dude, yeah. Melody. So let me ask you this: like, as a songwriter, when you're constructing melodies and you're thinking about lines and words, what's your process?
Well, I usually come up with a guitar riff first because I'm always noodling on guitar, and then I come up with something, and then the melodies just come to me when it's the right chord structure, the right riff, or it just makes you feel something, and just keep working with it. My problem, not problem, but I'm always slow with the lyrics.
It always takes the longest.
Oh, my God.
Because you're like, I don't want to sound like I'm being too romantic or not ballsy
or
enough.
Preachy. Yes, or preachy. Is somebody going to want to hear this?
That's you trying to censor it.
Too? Yeah, and it just sometimes freezes you in your tracks.
Right.
Where
did you learn how to sing? And where did you, like, what were some of the singers that were the most influential for you?
I've always been able to sing. Thank God.
Were you in the choir or anything like that?
No,
nothing.
Nothing. My mom played a lot of opera in the house.
Oh,
she
wow.
liked operas, and she liked.
You got the Italian. The
what course. Are you gonna do? You sing. That's what we do.
So, I remember in the bathroom, I used to sing all the time, and I'd sing. I'm not going to do it because it's too loud, but I would sing out like Pagliacci and all these things, and just could I just be making because I would get my dad to laugh,
right?
Because I'm always a cut up. I was like the class clown and stuff, but I would get him to laugh, and if I got him to laugh, it would just go on and on because my dad was a crack up too.
Right.
He would do these crazy voices that would they're just like horror movie voices. He would breathe in while he talked and it was just this crazy stuff. But I would do, and I remember we had a house and we had four rentals in the back where I grew up. And I remember the ladies that lived in the back, they were older ladies. They go, who is that singing in the house? Boy, that kid's got a voice. You should work with that.
And you're like, that's me. That's me.
And I was embarrassed because I didn't think they could hear it. And then I quit doing it for a while. And the guy, we never hear Greg singing anymore. So is he okay? I faked my own death one time when I was a little kid. My sister, I had my sister do a... God, me and my sisters were crazy. We would do anything. I mean, I had this paper route, and I had the mumps. I don't know how we got on this.
But hey, that's all right. This is what makes the interview interesting.
So I had the mumps for a couple of weeks or whatever, a week or 2 weeks. And the people come out, well, where's Greg? Because every day I would deliver the... And I always talk to the older people. And, you know, I'm 12 years old at the time. And so my sister, I go, just tell him I died or got hit by a car or lost his leg. Just anything. So my sister...
You just want the reaction.
Yeah. And so my sister actually did it. They go, where's your brother? Is he okay? I go, no, he lost his leg. So these people came over to the house because the paper route was right in my neighborhood. So I'm in the bed. We had a fold-out bed in the living room, and we put it down and sleep in it if you were sick. That's where that was sick room because you could watch TV all day. So I folded my leg and had it hanging out of the bed, just the knee. And these people would look at him. My sister would stand in front, like, but they'd let him get a lick. I let him get a look at him, and I'd be in
just
bed.
Just enough.
Just enough to think, oh, my God.
Oh, my God, that poor
My mother found
walk.
Out and beat the living shit out of me. She did not let... Every time she thought about it, she beat the hell out of me.
She's like, you're not going
to
be that
she
guy.
She had me walk and apologize to everybody in the neighborhood.
Wow.
But
making
that's
you accountable.
My mom would, yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah, totally.
That's respect right there.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
totally.
Like, you're not going to walk around and be that vagrant.
So I knew I couldn't get away with anything. That's why I never got in any trouble. I was scared. My dad was a boxer. I mean, he'd hit you one time. You didn't even know who the hell you were.
Wow.
Well, where the hell it came from. You wake up shaking and it's like, what the hell just happened?
So when did you get the courage to start singing?
In junior high school.
For girls?
No, I just did it because I was in the band and nobody else could sing.
You're like, I can do this.
I can do it. Yeah, my dad would always. I remember I was in second grade and my Aunt Gladys bought me a little transistor radio. And that was the rage back then in like 68, something like that. Whatever, however, you know, I was born in 58. So however you are in third grade. And I'm going home and the Osmonds are on or something like that. And I'm singing along with it. And I'm thinking, God, I can do this. And I'm walking home. I had a mile walk to and from school. And I remember late old ladies and you know, stuff smiling at me while I was singing. And I was just in my own little world. You know, I just thought it was the greatest thing ever that I could, because my dad could sing. And I just thought, how cool would it be to be able to.
I was just about to say, like, that. It sounds like your dad was one of the most influential singers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he was total supportive of me.
My dad was the same way. He was a singer. And you know what? It's like, I'd hear him singing, I'd be like, that's awesome that he loves music like that. Yeah. I remember him still like trying to like learn to play piano, but it's funny that as a kid, we see that as like, oh, these are goals. I want to be able to do that. It's like a magical thing to hear it,
and
you know?
My dad was real protective over us kids, you know? He didn't want any guys messing with my sisters and, you know, and he was protective over me because I was kind of little and skinny. And there was a lot of jealous people because I was getting girls and, you know, I was in a band, everybody,
right.
You know.
You were the town legend, man.
But my dad, it was funny because, but he didn't know rock and roll. He knew the old standards and
right.
stuff. So he didn't really know if I was good or not. He just knew I was playing all the time. So he said the moment that he knew that I had something, and this I'll never forget as long as I live, he was sitting in his old Oldsmobile in front of Glendale, Maple Park in Glendale. I played a big Halloween party or something there. The whole damn city was there. I mean, it was a big riot when they had us quit at 10.
Wow.
But he was sitting in his car, and he said all he heard was Leon's playing tonight. Leon's playing. You know that Leon's here, right?
Yeah, everybody's playing. Just from people walking by.
Yeah, people walking by
wow.
the car. And he's going, man, that's what they used to say with Glenn Miller. They called him Miller, and, hey, you know Miller's playing tonight. And, you know, you're going to see Miller? And
that's
he
crazy.
Said, and he goes, Greg, just keep doing what you're doing because you got it. If they're talking about you like that, you must have something.
And you're like, yes, Dad.
And so, he would stay there just to make sure nobody messed with me.
Isn't that honestly the greatest accolade? Because I remember when my dad said the same thing. Like, he saw me playing at the House of Blues, and I remember him looking over and just seeing all these people. And he came. He's like, "This is what you need to do with your life." And I'm like, "Yeah, welcome, welcome to the party."
It's funny,
you know? But that accolade is something you never forget.
Yeah, my dad and mom used to, in the early days, they got older and they didn't go out anymore. But in the early days, when I first started playing Hollywood, they would come out to Hollywood, like the Gazaris. And
yeah.
I remember there was...
That must have been a scene.
It was insane. I mean, all the girls from Glendale High School, all the girls from Hoover High School
wow.
showing up there to see us, and all the guys there because the girls were there.
Right.
Bill Gazzari wrote an article to Robert Hilburn talking about me, and I just uncovered
wow.
that. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. And he said I was the guy to watch out for.
Wow.
But I made so many stupid decisions by leaving bands too quick.
Why?
Or getting with
Tell
the
me
wrong.
Why.
I would get frustrated with things. It seemed like it should be happening faster. Mm. Or one band, it went out to be great. I kept catching the guy, and he's the lead singer in the band. I was doing backup. And we actually would share lead vocals, but I kept catching him in lies. And we're in Europe, and I'm not going to mention names, but anybody who knows me knows who I'm talking about. But I kept catching him in lies constantly. And I told the drummer, I go, look at this, man. We just watched him. And it was snowing when we were there. And when he went down to make a phone call in this bus stop right in front of where we were staying. And he comes back with the story. But I knew that he was full of shit. So I watched him the whole time. And I woke my drummer up at the time, Gary.
Yeah,
and I said, watch this. So he goes down there, smokes a cigarette, comes back. Never even touched the phone. Didn't even get within 5-10 feet of it.
Wow.
Comes back with this incredible story. I just kept giving Gary the eye like, yeah, 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 he did that. Sure. Yeah. It was so funny because we were supposed to open up for AC/DC. And he said AC/DC right. and Whitesnake. But I think it was David Coverdale busted his ankle or leg the day before the show. So it got postponed. And he got out of that one because...
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's
like,
And it never was going to happen, but he got so lucky by, you know, David Coverdale breaking
Did you feel like you didn't ride it out with certain bands because you weren't into the
yeah.
music?
No, or was it never
just,
about the music.
It was all just about, like, it needs to happen right now. It needs
well,
to move.
With Kevin DeBrow, with the Quiet Riot, the DeBrow thing, it was just impossible to be around him. When we first started playing together, it was amazing. I mean, he was just showing me off to everybody. I mean, I was the new Randy Rhoads guy in town,
right.
and... You know, we got all these songs we wrote together, which most of them made their first record that I didn't get credit for.
Wow.
And which was really shitty of him. Really shitty. But that's who he was. And, man, I was very bitter for a long time. And we ended up, the last show he ever did, we played together at Rocklahoma in Pryor, Oklahoma, at the big Rocklahoma 4-Day Festival.
Oh, it was in Oklahoma?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
And he...
Not just a clever name.
I had written an article about a year before that. I got interviewed for some online magazine, and they asked me about what was it like working with Kevin DeBrow, and I said, well, he was the biggest asshole I've ever met in this industry.
Wow.
And I go, I'm just going to leave it at that. So I hadn't talked to Kevin in 20 years, probably. And I get a phone call the next day. I guess he read the article, and he goes, Greg? I go, yeah. He goes, just so you know, it's a friendly phone call. I go, who's this? He goes, it's Kevin DeBrow.
You're like, oh,
I just
shit.
About shit myself. I'm like, oh, man. I go, you read the article? You read the article, didn't you? He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, was I really that bad? I go, dude, don't you remember the time? And he goes, no, I don't remember that. Oh, what about this time? And he goes, no, man, I don't remember that. And then he goes, well, I'm not that guy anymore. I go, yeah, right. And he goes, no, they got me on medication. And I started laughing. I thought that was the funniest thing, that he had to be put on medicine to control this.
But you know what? The funny thing is, in that age and that era too, you have, you know, girls, drugs, age, trying to prove yourself. And it's also like there's something that I find with music. It's like such a spiritual, beautiful thing. But you have all these egos flying around the room. And sometimes you can have something so beautiful in the room. And then as soon as it walks outside the room, it changes forms. Yeah. There's so many different things about it. So it's like, it's really hard to find. Like when I see the Stones, I'm like, dude, you've been together 50 plus years. How did you do it? Yeah. How did you do it? Because it's like unreal that a band
they only see
together.
Each other on stage, probably.
Maybe.
No, let me finish
maybe.
The story with
Kevin DeBose. Yeah, please.
He goes, would you do me a favor? You know, after we had this long conversation on the phone, he apologized, said he wasn't that guy anymore. He goes, would you do me a favor? I go, well, what's that, Kevin? He goes, would you retract that comment? Because I can take it off because it's online. I said, I'll call the guy, and if he'll do it, I'll do it. So I called the guy up.
That's nice of you to do that.
I called him up. I said, hey, we got to retract it because Kevin called me. He apologized, and I promised him I would if we could. So I called Kevin the next day. He called me the next day or whatever it was. It doesn't matter. And I got it, and I put a nice little thing, you know. And
that's
so
nice.
Then a couple of years later, we end up both getting booked at Rocklahoma. And so I'm there, and he pulls onto the lot. And I hadn't seen him in a while. Actually, I had seen him once. I used to have a big shop in Hollywood, an amp repair shop. And he was in front of me at line. And I just stood there. That was at the Subway sandwich shop, and I just stood there. And all of a sudden, he realized he was behind him, and he acted like I was his long-lost friend, and he was hugging me, and he was introducing me to his
and
girlfriend.
You're like, you're such a dick.
And I go back to my shop, and I'm getting madder. And I went back over to kick his ass. And I'm like 30 years old, 35, 40 years old at this point. And I go back in there, and he's gone. So anyway, so flash forward to the Rocklahoma thing. He's
right.
Pulling in with his equipment truck, and Frankie Benelli comes into the thing. I'm getting my money from the promoters there, and Frankie comes in to let him know they're there, and this, that, and the other. I go, hey, Frankie, how you doing, man? I go, is Kevin here? He goes, yeah, he's in the car. Well, Kevin had already seen me, so he's jumping over the bass player. I can't remember his name right now, Chuck. And he comes out, and he just hugs me, and he picks me up off the ground. He wants to spend all of his time with me just catching up. He told me that the band he had with me was probably the best because I never asked for money. I was just happy to play because that's all I wanted to do was play.
Right.
And he said, everybody else, all they want to do is talk about money. They're always like digging for more money. And it's just nothing but, you know, a hassle all the time. And
you don't know what you have until it's gone sometimes.
Yeah. So when he played, and the same thing happened with Don Dokken, when they played this, we all played the same day for some reason. And Kevin wanted me right on the side of the stage. He kept looking at me and smiling at Rocklahoma. And then when it was done, and anybody that knows me knows I hate it when somebody sweaty touches me.
I'm going to give you sweaty hugs now all the time.
Completely covered in sweat. Kevin comes, they finish the set. He comes and grabs me and my wife. We go backstage and we get caught up some more in their thing. And with Dokken, it was the funniest thing. My wife and I are on the same spot, but there's a live microphone right in front of us. I didn't know it was live. And I'm still a Dokken fan. You know, I love the music. I love being in the band.
Right.
But I need things to be up straight with me. You know,
right.
The guys that came in after me, they all call me the lucky one because I got out with my life and I can do whatever I want. They still got to go out and pretend it's 1983 again or whatever, you know. But anyways, so my wife is singing along with him and she's singing out her little heart out. And all of a sudden this guy comes running across the stage and it was the crazy, and he grabs the mic, and we didn't know the mic was on. She didn't know it was on. She's singing along, so there's like this harmony and going out into the mains.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because he had a wireless mic, and if that went out, he's got the live mic to go to. So, they give us a hard look.
They're like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're like, those.
It was funny, and Don was just so nice to me. And he told me the same thing, too, man. He goes, I look back on the gigs we did, the European tours and all the stuff. He goes, man, you were the easiest guy to work with because you didn't cause no shit with anybody.
You're like, you should have remembered that 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But, hey, let's talk about this track where you played all the instruments.
Yeah, this is a song that's going to be in my new record. Why am I doing a record? I don't know.
No, you know why you're doing a record? Because, A, you're good, and you've worked your entire life doing this to be good at it. And you know what? If you don't document it, what's it for?
Well, yeah, I got like about 17 songs in the can.
Crazy.
And this is one I did the other day, and I played everything on it, and I'm going to have a real keyboardist come in, a girl I went to school with, of all things. She's been helping my wife with her record on the keyboards. And just a great, great musician, Aaliyah Khan, and just wonderful. And we lost touch for 100 years and ran into her at a friend of mine's funeral. And I said, you know, I've always wanted to do something with you. And not in that way, because I'm married. But no.
She's like, so, you mean piano?
She goes, Greg, I've always wanted to work this. So we exchanged phone numbers, and I called her. And, man, she came right up and
That's
laid
amazing.
A track down on my wife's new record. So we got Yeah, so anyways, this song is called Falling, and I wrote this a long time ago, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle because it was kind of...
As all songs do. Yeah, I'm doing that right now. I'm gathering songs from 20 years ago trying to figure it out.
It's kind of a, not song, it's kind of heavy, but it's kind of sing-songy. And it, I love Boston. I love Boston.
I love Boston, too. I can hear a lot in your sound, too.
Well, yeah, and I just love Boston. And anyways, this is a song called Falling. I wrote it like 25, 30 years ago. But everybody said, it's not heavy enough. You got to be heavy. You got to go dark. But this is where my heart is, and songs where you can really sing it out. And so let's play Falling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right,
this is Falling. This one's not playing. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to play a song that you produced real quick, and I'll have Ronan put it up. This song is a song that you produced off your wife's record, right? What's the name of this one?
This is called I'm Going to Change Everything, and it's a 50-year-old Jim Reeves tune. But I heard her, and I never heard the song before. She sang it to me, and I figured out chords for it. And just we do some fundraisers and stuff, my wife and I. And she has an actual band that we go out and play. And
it's amazing you can collaborate on that level.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. She's amazing. The best thing that ever happened to me, without a doubt.
Oh, I hope she's listening.
I hope so, too. She knows it. I tell her all the time.
Otherwise, you just cue up this interview and be like, here it is, there.
When I'm begging her for sex, I tell her that.
You're like, please.
There's no begging
involved.
You're
the best thing ever.
Yeah. But this is a song that I produced for her, and I don't know how it really went, but this is the melody that she would sing to me. And I kept saying, that's a great song. Let's do it. But we couldn't find it. So anyways, this is it. I'm going to change everything. I think it was written by, she knows who it was written for because she got the clearance on it. But I think it was Jim Reeves back in the 40s or 50s.
Oh, wow.
And it's a country tune.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been doing a little country work and stuff just because I can play guitar. And I'm like
there's
a
so much. It all blends. Yeah, it all blends. So. All right. Here it is.
I'm going to change everything by Souza. That's my wife's name. S-U-Z-A.
Souza and I'm going to change everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna change everything that holds the memory of you. Oh yeah, I'm gonna start for the walls, taking pictures of the walls and the girls. Move the chairs around, take the window curtains down and down. Everything I see reminds me of the work here.
Do it.
Time to wake up, America.
That's the cock of approval. That's it. So that, you know what was cool about that? It's like that was a total style that I wouldn't have guessed you producing or, you know, kind of like knowing what to make sound like traditional in the way that it did.
I love my mother, aside from listening to a lot of classical, she loved country. She grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. Bluegrass and, you know, country. And there was a place I grew up next to in Glendale called Pizza Pete's. It was a great pizza place, but they had a stage. One time, and I was about 8 or 9 years old, they had a big stage set up on the side, and Chet Atkins.
Wow.
All of these guys that were big, and there was a radio station that used to play all the country right down the street, KFI or something. I don't remember the name of the call letters. So we walked over. My mom was excited. These are all the people that we loved, you know, Buck Owens and all these people. And I was right against the stage with my mom. And I just had so much fun, and I just, man, those guys could really play.
They're shredders. They're shredders, and they don't get enough credit for shredding.
No, they don't get enough credit at all. I mean, you know, obviously Hendrix and Frank Marino is my just amazing, amazing guitar player. But I just
what about Les Paul, man?
Well, he's got, Les Paul too, yeah, come on. And Hendrix and Frank Marino, and I love Trower too, but only the Bridge of Sighs record. Because the songs are just phenomenal on it. But I called Frank Marino about 6-8 months ago. My buddy Mark Tate and I were at my house, and we're sitting there at the table, and it was getting kind of late. And I opened my phone up, and I showed him that I had, you know, Frank's phone number.
He's like, let's call him.
He goes, get out of here. That's not it. I go, dude, I'm telling you, that's Frank Marino's phone number. He goes, where'd you get it? And I told him, the guy that did, John Harrell, that did the interview for the Burn magazine that I did, he gave it to me because I gave him all the questions to ask Frank. He didn't know anything about Frank. So he goes, how long have you had it? I said, I've been hiding it for about a year. So he's pretty persuasive, my buddy Mark. So I ended up calling him. Frank picks up on the first ring. We spoke for over an hour about electronics, about guitars, about tone, about amplifiers, about certain years of amplifiers, pedals, production, so much stuff. It was like a long-lost friend. And I had to pretend, it got so, and it was late for him. He's 3 hours later. Right. He's on the East Coast, I think, of Canada. And so I had to pretend there was another call coming in that I had to take to get off the phone.
You're like, listen, pen pal. Yeah. No, I've been let's do this later.
I've been a fan of his since the early 70s.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, I talk.
But you know what's like, you are like a wealth of knowledge like that. So like, when you find somebody that mirrors that, of course, you could talk until 10 years from now, just about gear.
Yeah.
I kind of like, I idolize people like that because it's like I still feel like a little kid in a candy shop with
that's
learning
how you're
all
supposed
this stuff.
To feel,
yeah,
though.
And it's but you know what? It's like I respect how much knowledge people know about. Yeah. Like all the little things when I ask you about tubes and I ask you about like you know modifying amps.
Are you a
stuff
reader?
Like that.
Do you read a lot?
Oh, I love
me
reading.
Too. I have a you know, you've been to my shop and all the fish that I breed and stuff. I have an actual room that is almost nothing but study material on cichlids, fish.
Wow.
And the type of fish that I breed, the African cichlids from Lake Tanganyika and Lake Malawi and some from Lake Victoria, there is so much to know.
Yes.
And, I mean, I literally have hundreds and hundreds of books and atlases.
You could be like the resource that they need in Africa.
I've written articles for magazines and they've been published.
Wow, that's crazy.
But, you know, that's just one of the nerd sides. I mean, I love also working on cars.
Well, it's, you
I
know,
don't
I
do
find
it so
that,
much anymore.
I find that
of
all artists that love something that see it through love something else that they also want to study just because it's a hobby. It's because you want to, you respect how much time goes into accessing the information.
I've had fish nonstop since I was 6 or 7 years old. Never did not have fish. I have a pond in my backyard with fish that come from a river system in Georgia that nobody has here, and I'm breeding them.
That's crazy.
It's insane. I mean, but if you like that kind of stuff, you know, you're passionate about it, you know. My wife, you know, she used to laugh. She goes, well, at least he's not out, you know, looking at porno. He's looking at fish porn. She'd walk past the room with a computer, and I'm looking up fish, and, you know.
She's like, some guys just, you know,
love
fish?
Yeah, guys are out drinking and hanging out at bars. No, Greg's at home. He's
you're
playing
like, no, I've got some fish to study about. Let's play this track. So let's, I think I put it in the computer, so it should work. Tell me about this track. You said Fallen, you played all the instruments.
I played everything on it. I'm going to bring in Aaliyah Khan to do the keys in a week or so. Because I'm not really, I know chords, but I don't have that thing, and I know I don't have it for keyboards. She does. And so, you know, I love Foreigner. I love bands that have songs.
You love songs, yeah.
And melodies, and that's what I was trying to do with this, is do something like maybe Foreigner would do. A love song type of a thing, and it's something that just makes you think and, you know, whatever. But I wrote it a long time ago. It kind of got lost in the shuffle. And it came to me a couple months ago. I go, man, that was a good song. I should. So I found a demo I did in Arizona on it. And it was in the wrong key. I mean, I changed it up. But anyway, this is what I came up with. It's a song called Fallen. And
here's Fallen.
I just did the bass on it 2 days ago. Don't tell me it's not going to work.
Hold on.
Are you kidding?
I don't know what's going on
with
this.
I don't either.
Let's see. Hold on. Let me try this again.
Nope.
That's not it.
I'm going to change it.
What is this? Let's see. I'll try one more time. Hold on.
Nope.
That's not it.
Wait.
Well, you know what? Yeah, that one went down. We're just monkeying around at this point. Well, you know what? This gives us incentive to have you back on the show.
Hello?
Tell us about this. You had a 29-page interview
that
was written about you in Japan. Tell us about that.
Well, this man who I've become really good friends with now at this point, one of the funniest guys I've ever met, John Harrell. They call him Shooter, and he writes for Burn Magazine. They wanted to find out about me because it's funny, in Japan, my records are like totally collectible, and I've made it to some of the desert island. They have the journalist. What would you, if you had to go to desert island, could take 10 albums with you? And
that's amazing.
Yeah, they had 10 guys, and like four of them had my name, and that's why I ended up doing the Wishing Well records. I thought it was over, and they go, no, man, people in Japan love you.
He's like, I'm huge. You're the David Hasselhoff of Japan,
and
dude.
I'm really big in Barstow, too.
That's awesome. But you know what? That's how it works sometimes.
So John gets in touch with me. He comes up to the house. And we do an interview, and it went on and on, and we're just cracking. And he's like, dude, I can't believe that all this stuff happened. You got so close so many times. And it was always somebody else that messed it up, except, you know, for sometimes I left a band too long, but there was just internal stuff that I didn't want to deal with, and I won't get into that. But anyways, we became really good friends. We go out to dinner a couple times a month, and this was like a year and a half, 2 years ago. We call each other all the time, and I've helped him out with some interviews of people that he really didn't know who they were, like the Frank Marino thing. He just didn't, it was under his radar. He didn't know. So, and we just become very good friends. And there was 29 typewritten pages.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. But they have symbols for the words. So they fit it into like 9 pages.
Wow.
And there's all these photographs and stuff. And some of the photographs, I had been in an explosion.
What?
Yeah. I had been in an explosion. It was my wife and I's first.
Say that one more time. Yeah. Hold on. I'm finding it. Give me a second. Okay. It's coming. Wait, I don't have it here. Maybe you can find it. Maybe I'm way off.
I don't know.
Man, this is not good. That's definitely not it.
Hey, the microphone is on. Take it easy, man.
So anyways, you did this big spread. Did they document your whole life and just kind of like
much,
put it all in a nutshell? And they're like,
it was too much for them to even get in 29 pages. I mean, they left out the original Greg Leon Invasion with Joey Vera in it and Carl James and also a bunch of people. But it was a great article, and it's Burn Magazine. It's got Ritchie Blackmore on the cover, which is an honor for me because I love Ritchie Blackmore. And it took a bunch of pictures. And the thing that bummed me out, some of the pictures, the recent ones, at the time, I had been in an explosion and burned all of my freaking hair off.
Wow.
And I, you know, I'd been maybe a year from...
I know. This is a weird fact in
your
story.
You want to hear something really weird? Is it was Christmas Eve. It was my wife and my first year in the house.
Sorry, I'm picturing you.
Here's how stupid I was that night, not thinking. I wasn't drinking or nothing.
I'm listening.
So I... Hello?
Why you do this to me?
So anyways, I couldn't get the fireplace started. I ordered some wood, a half quart of wood,
right,
and it would not start. So underneath the house in the storage area, I know I had a few boxes of starter fluid for cars.
Right.
Well, I sprayed the shit out of this wood, and I went to light it. And I'm, you know, kneeling in front of the fireplace. And as soon as I clicked that thing with that little spark, it exploded and knocked me to the ground. And I was inside of a fireball. And I had...
It's the closest I can get to an explosion.
You're up. Thank you. And anyways, it knocked me to the ground. My wife was in the washroom doing some... And this is Christmas Eve, by the way. I called all of my friends. I got to get something to kill the pain. I had burns on my arms where the skin was just hanging.
Oh, my God.
Second, third degree burns. Luckily, the guy next door checked his messages. And I knew they were all in the medical field, but I didn't know what they did. He goes, well, hang on. My mom's on her way over. And I'm going, what's she going to tuck me in or hug me? I don't know what. She's a burn
unit. Look, I can use it.
She's a burn unit doctor.
Oh, my God.
She had all of her stuff with her. She came over twice a day. Excuse
Nursed
me, for
the
2 weeks.
Wow.
Cut all the dead skin off. Sterilized it, gave me all the Sovodine, wrapped it in gauze.
That's
I have
crazy.
No scars. My hair came back. But what? And another thing, right after that happened, I met, what's his name? The guy that produced Jimi Hendrix. Eddie Kramer. I met Eddie Kramer at the NAMM show.
Wow.
And my wife took pictures. I just looked like the biggest dweeb.
You're like, where's my hair?
I know. So I told him, that I was a Hendrix fan and a big fan of his. So he had a guitar and some pedals because he does a pedal line now. So he sits me down and I look like this idiot with my hair, like all the way back to the middle. It just looked like I was in a fire because I wasn't a fire.
Right.
Like Fire Marshal Bill or something.
Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something.
So anyways, I'm sitting there playing guitar and he's kneeling in front of me, but working the pedals. And I go, you want me to do some Hendrix? And probably everybody says it.
Right.
So I did some Band of Gypsy stuff.
Oh, my God.
They're really hard to figure out. And I did this with the little trills and all the weird inversions and stuff. And he looked up at me and goes, wow, do that again. He goes, I don't think I've ever heard anybody do that right before.
Wow.
He goes, I think that's the way he did it. And so...
Dude, what a compliment.
Yeah, totally a compliment. So we ended up talking a few times after that. And I was going to do a video for him for his pedals. And then I had trigger finger in my left hand, and I had to go get shots for that to get rid of that. But I couldn't play guitar good, and I was scared to book a date because I didn't know if I was going to, have the damn trigger finger. Now I'm fine. I just played two shows last weekend. No, one show last weekend and two shows the weekend before. But I'm fine now. But, I never did that video for him, and I really wanted to be associated with him. But it was my own fault for my hands.
It may still happen. There's still time.
Oh, good, sure. But he was cool as heck, man. It was just really cool.
You know what? A lot of people don't know that you've been fixing my amps for 10 plus years. And you know what? You're the guy. I don't think you realize your legendary status outside of your playing is also how well you fix amps. If people want to find you online for your music or to fix amps or gear, where can they find you?
Well, I do all the amp repairs for the last 10 years for True Tone Music in Santa Monica.
I love that store.
Yeah, it's the best. It is the best.
It is the best.
And I feel honored to be associated with them because everybody in there is just a master craftsman. And I do that stuff. And I used to have my own shop in Hollywood. I still have a shop at my house. The rent just got too stupid in Hollywood.
Right,
I mean, it was
$2,200
bucks a month. And my wife and I were living on the beach in Santa Monica, that rent, and then, helping my mom out before she passed away with, you just can't save any money when it's like
right.
that. So, anyways, I closed the shop down and moved up to the house. I had a 18 by 18 room, and I just work out of that. You've been up there.
Yeah.
And it's perfect.
It's awesome.
It's perfect. And
it's like your little lab.
It's my
your little mad
lab.
Scientist
yeah.
lab.
That's everybody says that.
So, gregleoninvasion@hotmail.com is how people can email you.
Yeah.
And you can look for you as Greg Leon or Greg Leon Invasion.
Right.
Either way.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to come back and do some more stuff.
Because
I could do it like a 10
piece. Oh, we're not even a quarter of the
way
done.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. It's like my favorite interviews are the ones where it feels like it go on for 10 hours. That's what I love. So you got to come back 3 to 6 months and we're going to go through.
Wait.
Woo! You comedian, you. Oh, They're good. Well, Greg, go ahead. Hit your favorite one.
There's so many of them.
I know there's so many. It's crazy. This is one of my favorites. And
they're off. Hey, wait a minute. Are you holding? Dude, you better flush that, man.
But I paid for this sound. I paid for that one. That one was not on the house, so
that
I paid for
that
one.
Might be my favorite one. Hey, something's in the other room.
Hey, oh, no! Hey, close it! See,
well,
I got you addicted to the soundboard. That's one of my favorite parts of this whole thing.
I had a thing in my phone of all these fart noises, and I was visiting a bunch of my relatives in Vegas. I must have drove them nuts. It was
They
couldn't get anything done because all they heard were fart noises.
Yeah, the fart noises are good. That's one of my favorites. I was trying to do this when you were talking about your dad teaching how to box. I was trying to, but it's hard because it's not an actual soundboard. I got to flip through screens. So, anyways, Greg Leon Invasion, LEONGREG, Invasion. If you don't know how to spell it, look it up.
Invasion.
That's right.
It's that
and
simple.
Check out his music. Check him out for amp repair. Just check him out, period.
There's videos on YouTube of me playing live, some concerts and stuff. And some people, fans of mine, have put together just like collages with some of my early music.
Sizzle reels?
Yeah, I guess that's what they are. Yeah.
Yep. Well, but, Greg, it's been a pleasure, man. We got to do this again. This is going to be one of six. I'm just calling it at least six. This is going to be a six-part interview.
That'd be awesome.
But
man,
thank you for coming by. We're going to have to have you back. And on behalf of Ronan and myself and all our listeners, we'll see you guys next week.